The next order of business here is the acceptance speech by Vice President Humphrey, who will be along in a minute. They're now appointing a committee to escort him into the auditorium. And he then will speak. And we predict he will accept the nomination. He, in talking to members of Mr. Humphrey's, Vice President Humphrey's campaign staff in the last few weeks, Chet, they never had any doubt, he never had any doubt, that he was going to win the nomination. But he was worried that within the Democratic Party, even though he was going to be nominated, he was not loved. And politicians need to be loved. They want votes, of course. They want lots of them, but they like to have them lovingly cast. And he has indeed won the nomination, and there is indeed a wide split here in the party in this hall. It's been reflected in a dozen different ways since these sessions began at the beginning of this week. The formality is to appoint a committee of party leaders of one kind or another, Congress, governors, and various others. They march out back, walk out back of the rostrum where the vice president is waiting, inform him that he has been nominated and that the convention is awaiting his acceptance. And he will come through that door.
One of our people managed to get into that back room the other day when there was no great impending matter of state. And he said it was almost funereal back there. People in chairs sitting there going over their notes and their speeches for the last time, making their corrections, nervous about that terrible moment when they would walk out on the platform and face this convention. No one said anything to each other, and it was a very odd atmosphere.
NBC News is in contact with the Chicago Police Department, inviting the officer who arrested the chairman of the New Hampshire delegation to come in and appear on television and tell his version of what happened. We have not yet had a response. John Ford of NBC News tells us that Governor Connally of Texas had some kind words for the Chicago police and Mayor Daley. He referred to the demonstrators who were the object of their attacks last night as terrorists and anarchists, and he said the police and the mayor had been put in a very difficult situation in trying to provide security for innocent people. He said some of the police might have overreacted, but he said by and large they were restrained, well-trained, and worthy of being commended. That's from Governor Connally of Texas.
Downtown tonight, David, tear gas has been used to disperse about 2,000 demonstrators at 18th and Michigan. At least four vanloads of demonstrators were arrested, including Dr. John Cashin of Alabama, who led one of the groups of Alabama dissidents, and the comedian Dick Gregory. Two National Guardsmen were injured during the incident. Other demonstrators, presumably from the group which had been at 18th and Michigan, now have started filtering back into Grant Park.
Mr. Humphrey, in his speech here tonight, has a formidable job. And it is to say whatever he might find to say, trying to unify a party that is badly divided, partly badly divided because of the, among the candidates, winners and losers. There are one winner and two, three losers. Badly divided over its policy on Vietnam, and badly upset by what has happened in and outside the convention hall here in Chicago. Some of the delegates last night left here angry and bitter and were saying that the events of last night probably cost the Democrats the election in November. They may change their minds later, but in any case, that's what they were saying last night. Vice President Humphrey, in his acceptance speech, certainly will have to try to make some reference to the arguments, the fights, the divisions, the violence in Chicago without being so pointed about it as to stir up the anger again, and to try, however he can, to bring the party together. He's coming into the hall now. Let's go down to the rostrum.
Thank you.
life, Vice President Hubert Humphrey has made many crucial or key speeches. But perhaps this hour is the moment of truth. This one could be more crucial than any is ever delivered, because he has to unite this party, which, let's face it, is certainly not united at this moment. And this is a big opportunity, of course, to try it. There probably are more people listening and watching tonight than there will be at any other time throughout the campaign, any other one time. And, of course, the speech comes on the heels of all the events that have taken place here in Chicago throughout the week. It comes following all the bitter argument and the quarrels and fratricide which marked this convention.
Thank you. Bless your heart.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, my fellow Americans, my fellow Democrats, I proudly accept the nomination of our party. This moment is one of personal pride and gratification, yet one cannot help but reflect the deep sadness that we feel over the troubles and the violence which have erupted regrettably and tragically in the streets of this great city, and for the personal injuries which have occurred. Surely we have now learned the lesson that violence breeds counter-violence, and it cannot be condoned, whatever the source. I know that every delegate to this convention shares tonight my sorrow and my distress over these incidents. And may we, for just one moment, in sober reflection and serious purpose, may we just quietly and silently, each in our own way, pray for our country. And may we just share for a moment a few of those immortal words of the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi, words which I think may help heal the wounds, ease the pain, and lift our hearts. Listen to this immortal saint. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Those are the words of a saint. And may those of us of less purity listen to them well. And may America tonight resolve that never, never again shall we see what we have seen. Yes, I accept your nomination in this spirit that I have spoken, knowing that the months and the years ahead will severely test our America. And might I say that as this America is tested, that once again we give our testament to America. And I do not think it is sentimental, nor is it cheap, but I think it is true that each and every one of us in our own way should once again reaffirm to ourselves and our posterity that we love this nation, we love America. But take heart, my fellow Americans. This is not the first time that our nation has faced a challenge to its life and its purpose. And each time that we've had to face these challenges, we have emerged with new greatness and with new strength. We must make this moment of crisis, we must make it a moment of creation. As it has been said, in the worst of times, a great people must do the best of things, and let us do it. We stand at such a moment now in the affairs of this nation because, my fellow Americans, something new, something different has happened. There is an end of an era, and there is the beginning of a new day. And it is the special genius of the Democratic Party that it welcomes change, not as an enemy, but as an ally. Not as a force to be suppressed, but as an instrument of progress to be encouraged. This week, our party has debated the great issues before America in this very hall. And had we not raised these issues, troublesome as they were, we would have ignored the reality of change. Had we just papered over the differences between us with empty platitudes, instead of frank, hard debate, we would deserve the contempt of our fellow citizens and the condemnation of history. Yes, we dared to speak out, and we have heard hard and sometimes bitter debate, but I submit that this is the debate. And this is the work of a free people, the work of an open convention, and the work of a political party responsive to the needs of this nation. Democracy affords debate, discussion, and dissent. But, my fellow Americans, it also requires decision. And we have decided here, not by edict, but by vote, not by force, but by ballot. Majority rule has prevailed, but minority rights are preserved. Always the temptation, always the temptation to leave the scene of battle in anger and despair. But those who know the true meaning of democracy accept the decision of today, but never relinquishing their right to change it tomorrow. In the space of but a week, This convention has literally laid the foundations of a new Democratic Party structure in America. From precinct level to the floor of this convention, we have revolutionized our rules and our procedures. And that revolution is in the proud tradition of our party. It is in the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt, who knew that America had nothing to fear but fear itself. And it is in the tradition of that one and only Harry Truman, who let him have it and told it like it was. And that's the way we're going to do it from here on out. And it is in the tradition of that beloved man, Adlai Stevenson, who talked sense to the American people. And oh, tonight, how we miss this great, good, and gentle man of peace in America. And my fellow Americans, all that we do and all that we ever hope to do must be in the tradition of John F. Kennedy, who said to us, ask not what your country can do for you, but what can you do for your country? And my fellow Democrats and fellow Americans, in that spirit of that great man, let us ask what together we can do for the freedom of man. And what we are doing is in the tradition of Lyndon B. Johnson, who rallied a grief-stricken nation. A grief-stricken nation when our leader was stricken by the assassin's bullet and said to you and said to me and said to all the world, let us continue. And in the space of 5 years since that tragic moment, President Johnson has accomplished more of the unfinished business of America than any of his modern predecessors. And I truly believe that history will surely record the greatness of his contribution to the people of this land. And tonight to you, Mr. President, I say thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. my fellow Democrats, we have recognized, and indeed we must recognize, the end of an era and the beginning of a new day. And that new day belongs to the people, to all the people, everywhere in this land of the people, to every man, woman, and child that is a citizen of this republic. And within that new day lies nothing less than the promise seen a generation ago by that poet Thomas Wolfe. To every man, his chance. To every man, regardless of his birth, his shining golden opportunity. To every man, the right to live and to work and to be himself and to become whatever thing his manhood and his vision can combine to make him. This is the promise of America. Yes, the new day is here. Across America, throughout the entire world, the forces of emancipation are at work. We hear freedom's rising chorus. Let me live my own life. Let me live in peace. Let me be free, say the people. And that cry is heard today in our slums, on our farms, and in our cities. It is heard from the old as well as from the young. It is heard in Eastern Europe, and it is heard in Vietnam. And it will be answered by us in how we face the three realities that confront this nation. The first reality is the necessity for peace in Vietnam and in the world. The second reality is the necessity for peace and justice in our cities and in our nation. And the third reality is the paramount necessity for unity, unity in our country. Let me speak first, then, about Vietnam. There are differences, of course. Serious differences within our party on this vexing and painful issue of Vietnam. And these differences are found even within the ranks of all of the Democratic presidential candidates. But might I say to my fellow Americans that once you have examined the differences, I hope you will also recognize the much larger areas of agreement. Let those who believe that our cause in Vietnam has been right, or those who believe that it has been wrong, agree here and now that neither vindication nor repudiation will bring peace or be worthy of this country. The question is not the yesterdays, but the question is, what do we do now? No one knows what the situation in Vietnam will be when the next president of the United States takes that oath of office on January 20th, 1969. But every heart in America prays that by then we shall have reached a ceasefire in all Vietnam and be in serious negotiation towards a durable peace. Meanwhile, as a citizen, a candidate, and vice president, I pledge to you and to my fellow Americans that I shall do everything within my power, within the limits of my capacity and ability, to aid the negotiations and to bring a prompt end to this war. Remind you of the words of a truly great citizen of the world, Winston Churchill. It was he who said, and we would heed his words well, those who use today and the present to stand in judgment of the past may well lose the future. And if there is any one lesson that we should have learned, it is that the policies of tomorrow need not be limited by the policies of yesterday. Fellow Americans, if it becomes my high honor to serve as president of these states and people, I shall apply that lesson to the search for peace in Vietnam as to all other areas of national policy. Now let me ask you, do you remember these words at another time in a different place? Peace and freedom do not come cheap. And we are destined, all of us here today, to live out most, if not all, of our lives in uncertainty and challenge and peril. The words of a prophet? Yes. The words of a president? Yes. The words of the challenge of today, yes, and the words of John Kennedy to you and to me and to posterity. Last week, we witnessed once again in Czechoslovakia the desperate attempt of tyranny to crush out the forces of liberalism by force and brutal power, to hold back change. But in Eastern Europe as elsewhere, the old era will surely end, and there as here, a new day will dawn. And to speed this day, we must go far beyond where we've been, beyond containment to communication, beyond the emphasis of differences to dialogue, beyond fear to hope. We must cross those remaining barriers of suspicion and despair. We must halt the arms race before it halts humanity. And is this a vain hope? Is it but a dream? I say the record says no. Within the last few years, we have made progress. We have negotiated a nuclear test ban treaty. We have laid the groundwork for a nuclear non-proliferation treaty. We have reached agreement on banning weapons in outer space. We have been building patiently, stone by stone, each in our own way, the Cathedral of Peace. And now we must take new initiatives, with prudence and caution, but with perseverance. We must find the way and the means to control and reduce offensive and defensive nuclear missile systems. The world cannot indefinitely hope to avoid nuclear war, which one rash act, one error in judgment, one failure in communications could unleash upon all humanity and destroy all of mankind. But the search for peace is not for the timid or the weak. It must come from a nation of high purpose, firm, without being belligerent, resolute, without being bellicose, strong, without being arrogant. And that's the kind of an America that will help build the peace of this world. But the task of slowing down the arms race, of halting the nuclear escalation, there is no more urgent task than ending this threat to the very survival of our planet. And if I am elected as your president, I commit myself, body, mind, and soul, to this task. Now, our second reality is the necessity for peace at home. There is, my friends, let's see it as it is. There is trouble in America. But it does not come from a lack of faith, but it comes from the kindling of hope. When the homeless can find a home, they do not give up the search for a better home. When the hopeless find hope, they seek higher hopes. And in 1960 and again in 1964, you, the American people, gave us a mandate to awaken America to its unmet needs. You asked us to get America moving again, and we have, and America is on the move. And we have awakened expectations. We have aroused new voices, and new voices that must and will be heard. We have inspired new hope in millions of men and women, and they are impatient, and rightly so, impatient now to see their hopes and their aspirations fulfilled. We have raised a new standard of life in our America, not just for the poor, but for every American, wage earner, businessman, farmer, school child, and housewife. A standard by which the future progress must be judged. Our most urgent challenge is in urban America, where most of our people live. Some 70% of our people live on 2% of our land, and within 25 years, 100 million more will join our national family. I ask you tonight,
Where shall they live? How shall they live? What shall be their future? We are going to decide in the next 4 years those questions. The next president of the United States will establish policies not only for this generation, but for children yet unborn. Our task is tremendous, and I need your help. The simple solution of the frustrated and the frightened to our complex urban problems is to lash out against society. But we know, and they must know, that this is no answer. Violence breeds more violence. Disorder destroys. And only in order can we build. Riot makes for ruin. Reason makes for solution. So from the White House, to the courthouse, to the city hall, every official has the solemn responsibility of guaranteeing to every American, black and white, rich and poor, the right to personal security. Life. Every American, black or white, rich or poor, has the right in this land of ours to a safe and a decent neighborhood. And on this there can be no compromise. Put it very bluntly, rioting, burning, sniping, mugging, traffic in narcotics, and disregard for the law are the advance guard of anarchy, and they must and they will be stopped. But may I say most respectfully, particularly to some who have spoken before, the answer lies in reasoned, effective action by state, local, and federal authority. The answer does not lie in an attack on our courts, our laws, or our Attorney General. We do not want a police state, but we need a state of law and order. We do not want a police state, but we need a state of law and order. And neither mob violence nor police brutality have any place in America. And I pledge to use every resource that is available to the presidency, every resource available to the president, to end for once and for all the fear that is in our cities. Nor can there be any compromise with the right of every American who is anxious and willing to learn to have a good education. And it is to these rights, the rights of law and order, the rights of life, the rights of liberty, the right of a job, the right of a home and a decent neighborhood, and the right of an education. It is to these rights that I pledge my life and whatever capacity and ability I have. But we cannot be satisfied with merely repairing that which is old. We must also move beyond the enclosures of our traditional cities to create new cities, to restore our present cities, yes, and we must bring prosperity and modern living and opportunity to our rural areas. We must design an open America, opening new opportunities for new Americans in open land. I say to this audience, we have invested billions to explore outer space where man may live tomorrow. We must also be willing to invest to develop inner space right here on Earth where man may live today. And now that third reality, essential if the other two are to be achieved, is the necessity, my fellow Americans, for unity in our country, for tolerance and forbearance, for holding together as a family. And we must make a great decision. Are we to be one nation, or are we to be a nation divided? Divided between black and white, between rich and poor, between north and south, between young and old, I take my stand. We are and we must be one nation, united by liberty and justice for all, one nation under God, indivisible with liberty and justice for all. This is our America. Just as I've said to you, there can be no compromise on the right of personal security. There can be no compromise on securing of human rights. If America is to make a crucial judgment of leadership in this coming election, then let that selection be made without either candidate hedging or equivocating. Winning the presidency for me is not worth the price of silence or evasion on the issue of human rights. Winning the presidency, and listen well, winning the presidency is not worth a compact with extremism. I choose not simply to run for president. I seek to lead a great nation. And either we achieve true justice in our land, or we shall doom ourselves to a terrible exhaustion of body and spirit. I base my entire candidacy on the belief which comes from the very depths of my soul, which comes from basic religious conviction, that the American people will stand up, that they will stand up for justice and fair play, and that they will respond to the call of one citizenship one citizenship open to all for all Americans. So this is the message that I shall take to the people, and I ask you to stand with me. And to all of my fellow Democrats now who have labored hard and openly this week at the difficult and sometimes frustrating work of democracy, I pledge myself to that task of leading the Democratic Party to victory in November. Say to those who have differed with their neighbor or those who have differed with a fellow Democrat, may I say to you that all of your goals, that all of your high hopes, that all of your dreams, all of them will come to naught if we lose this election, and many of them can be realized with the victory that can come to us. And now a word to two good friends, to my friends, and they are my friends, and they're your friends, and they're fellow Democrats, to my friends Gene McCarthy and George McGovern. To my friends Gene McCarthy and George McGovern, who have given new hope to a new generation of Americans that there can be greater meaning in their lives, that America can respond to men of moral concern, to these two good Americans, I ask your help for our America, and I ask you to help me in this difficult campaign that lies ahead. And now I appeal to you, to those thousands, yea, millions of young Americans, to join us not simply as campaigners, but to continue as vocal, creative, and even critical participants in the politics of our time. Never were you needed so much, and never could you do so much if you were to help now. Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream. Robert F. Kennedy, as you saw tonight, had a great vision. If America will respond to that dream and that vision, if America will respond to that dream and that vision, their deaths will not mark the moment when America lost its way, but it will mark the time when America found its conscience. These men have given us inspiration and direction. And I pledge from this platform tonight We shall not abandon their purposes. We shall honor their dreams by our deeds now and in the days to come. I am keenly aware of the fears and the frustrations of the world in which we live. It is all too easy, isn't it, to play on these emotions? But I do not intend to do so. I do not intend to appeal to fear, but rather to hope. I do not intend to appeal to frustration, but rather to your faith. I shall appeal to reason and to your good judgment. The American presidency is a great and powerful office, but it is not all powerful. It depends most of all upon the will and the faith and the dedication and the wisdom of the American people. And I know, as you know, there is an essential strength in the American people. And tonight I call you, the American people, not to be of one mind, but to be of one spirit. I call you, the American people, not to a life of false security, false promises and ease, but to a new sense of purpose, a new dedication, and a new commitment. Remember that those who founded this republic said that in order to secure these inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. I submit, my fellow Americans, we dare do no less in our time if this republic is to survive. So I call you forth. I call forth that basic goodness that is there. I call you to risk the hard path of greatness. And I say to America, put aside recrimination and dissension. Turn away from violence and hatred. Believe. Believe in what America can do, and believe in what America can be. And with the help of that vast, unfrightened, dedicated, faithful majority of Americans, I say to this great convention tonight and to this great nation of ours, I am ready to lead our country.